passage is from Deuteronomy 1, chapter 1, verses 1 to 8, and that's found in the Church Bibles on page 178. Deuteronomy 1, verses 1 to 8. These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the desert east of the Jordan, that is, in the Arabah, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizeah. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all that the Lord had commanded him concerning them. This was after he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, and at Edrei had defeated Og, king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth. East of the Jordan, in the territory of Moab, Moses began to expound this law, saying, "The Lord our God said to us at Horeb, 'You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Break camp and advance into the hill country of the Amorites. Go to all the neighboring peoples in the Arabah, in the mountains, in the western foothills, in the Negev, and along the coast, to the land of the Canaanites, and to Lebanon, as far as the great river, the Euphrates. See, I have given you this land. Go in and take possession of the land that the Lord swore he would give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants after them.'"
Chuen, thank you for taking on those names and coping with them. Well, after a great and promising start, Deuteronomy chapter 1 turns out to be a study in failure and defeat. It's a chapter which ends in tears. Look at verse 45 with me, just for a moment. Still talking to the same people, Moses says, "You came back and wept before the Lord, but he paid no attention to your weeping and turned a deaf ear to you." So as the chapter ends in tears, tonight's sermon is going to be for all Liverpool fans. Deuteronomy chapter 1, if you like, is the spiritual equivalent of the post-mortem after yesterday's game. It comes out of a situation in which God's people Israel found themselves on the losing side. So we read Deuteronomy chapter 1. We're being invited to listen in as Moses, their leader, explains the reasons for their disastrous defeat. We're being taken into the boot room, if you like. Moses doesn't go over every detail of the battle, following every move, simply to make them feel miserable. It is a negative message, as we'll see, but he's telling them for a positive reason. Now, we need to get our bearings as we come to an Old Testament book like this. It's bad enough, isn't it, coming to terms with the names, let alone the geography and the culture and the history, and it seems like foreign territory to us. The green or whatever colour sheet it is meant to help with that, mostly for later on. I'm not going to cover the ground on there tonight in very much detail. Let me give us just a clue from the New Testament which will guide us in our thinking as we come to this unusual book, or what seems unusual to us at first. When Paul talks about Old Testament scriptures, he tells us this, quote, "Everything that was written in the past was written to teach us," that's us, "as Christian believers." And I think we'll find as we come to terms with this picture of the Old Testament Church of God, that it's painfully relevant to the churches today. And the reasons for their failure and defeat as we come to them, I think we'll find are remarkably contemporary. I'm going to try to take the whole of the first chapter tonight. Our series is going to take us through Deuteronomy at a fair old pace. We're going to go through 11 chapters over the next few weeks and then skip right to the end, fast forward to one of the final chapters. The first five verses tonight set the scene for us and introduce the major players. As we'll see, these verses come from the narrator or the commentator introducing the action for us. Most of the time, Moses speaks for himself. And verses 6 to 25, it's really, I suppose, the first half of the chapter, come directly from Moses, and they're designed to get God off the hook. We'll see. We'll read them together in due course. And then verses 26 to 46 spell out what went wrong at one critical moment in the history of God's people. And we'll go through it relatively slowly, and we'll be able, I think, to find our way in without too much difficulty. But those are the major landmarks, verses 1 to 5, verses 6 to 25, defending God, and verses 26 to 46, analyzing what was it that went wrong. And that's, I think, where we'll find particularly striking truths for us for today. So first, if you like headings, here's the first one, a painfully slow start, verses 1 to 5, a painfully slow start. Look back at verse 1. It tells us where Moses was speaking from. There, somewhere in the desert, east of the Jordan. That's the giveaway remark. It means they're still outside the promised land. They're on the right-hand side. The promised land is over the Jordan. We just sang about crossing over the Jordan. Well, they haven't done that yet in verse 1. We're not sure about the specific locations of those little place names, but we are talking about real places. Again, that's the point at this stage. This is not a sort of once upon a time over the hills and far away story. It's not that kind of account. If you look at verse 2, it comes in brackets. It's a kind of geographical reminder. It looks as though the NIV doesn't quite know what to do with it. It's in the text, but they put it in brackets because they can't quite make sense of it. It says it takes about 11 days to go from Mount Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. You can see those two places on the map. Mount Horeb down towards the Red Sea. It's also known as Mount Sinai. And Kadesh Barnea up towards the top of the map. It takes about 11 days to go from one to the other. Why on earth would we want to know that? In contemporary terms, I suppose verse 2 is the biblical equivalent of a printout from the computer software Autoroute. And if you have that on your PC anywhere, it's a great toy if you've never seen it. You tell the computer your starting point on your journey, and you tell the computer your destination. You say where you'd like to stop off for a quick one on the way, and for how long. You tell the computer what kind of driver you are, what your average speed is, 65 or 75 or whatever it may be, and what kind of vehicle you have, whether you're a GTX driver or you're driving a 2CV. Those are the categories in the software program. And it calculates how long each leg of the journey will take you and suggests the quickest route. Well, here, if you like, is a printout. It takes 11 days to go from Mount Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. But what's it doing here? Well, look at the beginning of verse 3. In the 40th year, on the first day of the month, Moses started saying these things. It's now 40 years, our commentator is telling us, since God's people left Egypt. And a journey that should have taken them just a few weeks at the most has taken them 40 years so far, and they've still not finished it. So what on earth is going on? And imagine for a moment you were an Egyptian filmmaker trying to make a documentary or a road movie telling Israel's story, leaving Egypt behind, escaping, and heading off to the promised land. Imagine trying to explain to the Cairo office that a journey which was supposed to take, well, a few months at the most, a film which would take a couple of months perhaps to shoot, has taken 40 years so far and they still haven't made it. They really are making slow progress. What's going on? After the last bank holiday, somebody was complaining to me that it took 11 hours to come back door to door by train from Scotland. There's nothing wrong with the trains, that was just how long the journey took. Well, imagine travelling back from Inverness at the same pace as God's people Israel, going through the desert. According to my calculations, it would be September next year before you got home. An 11-hour journey would take about 16 months at this pace. Can you imagine 16 months on a train? 16 months of sandwiches and coffee? It doesn't take all that much in our household, my parents' household, for somebody to start singing, "Why Are We Waiting?" very quietly at first and then getting louder and louder. Well, the obvious question as we come back to God's people still in the desert after all those years is, why are we still waiting? What's gone wrong? Can hardly have been traffic congestion in the wilderness or the wrong kind of leaves on the line. What was the reason for their painfully slow progress? Well, it certainly wasn't God's fault, says Moses. Look in verse 6. Moses takes the people who are listening to him in the desert back in their mind's eye, back to that mountain, Mount Horeb. And he reminds them what God said to them 40 years earlier on that mountain. Verse 6, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain," says God. Chris Wright, who is the principal of All Nations Christian College, tells a good story about this particular verse. He's relatively recently become the principal of the college. And he gave this verse as a text to his predecessor. Said to his predecessor, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain." He took it in very good heart. Now God felt the same about his people Israel. It was time for them to move on. They'd been meeting with him, listening to his word, but it was time to go ahead from there. Look at verse 8, which Tuen read to us. "See," God says, "I've given you this land." And verse 7 tells us it's a magnificent, enormous land. And God says in verse 8, "Go in and take possession of it. Take possession of the land the Lord swore he would give your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their descendants after them." If you're a bit of a Bible reader, you'll know that back in Genesis chapter 12, God promised Abraham that he would make him a great people, give his descendants a place of their own, and give them the privilege of a special relationship with him. Again, I've tried to illustrate that on the sheet. And from Genesis 12 onwards, one way of looking at the story of the whole Bible is that it shows us the various moves God makes in keeping his promises to Abraham. The first five books of the Bible, each concentrates on a different aspect of those original promises. So by the end of the first book, Genesis, Abraham's family is up to about 70. Start the next one, there are thousands of them. Exodus and Leviticus set out the shape of God's special relationship with his people. And Numbers and Deuteronomy are now looking on towards the land that God is going to give them. Now, verses 9 to 18 and 19 to 25, if you look, the NIV has very helpfully divided the chapter up for us into these paragraphs, are showing God's people in the desert that God has been doing what he said he would do. He's been keeping his promises to Abraham. Look at verse 10 with me, for instance. Moses speaking again. He said to the people, picking it up in verse 9, "You're too heavy a burden for me to carry alone. The Lord your God has increased your numbers so that today you are as many as the stars in the sky." I don't think he was just having a poetic day when he said that, feeling eloquent, as many as the stars in the sky. It wasn't a kind of throwaway phrase he just thought up. Moses is remembering Genesis 15, verse 5. Don't turn to it. I quote, "God took Abraham outside and said to Abraham, 'Abraham, look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' And then God said to Abraham, 'So shall your offspring be.'" And now, says Moses, look, he's done it. He's made you people, as many as the stars, just as he said he would do. And then Moses goes on, explaining that the growing numbers forced him into having a system of small groups. It wasn't just here that we have small groups, it was there too. And he explains his criteria for choosing group leaders and their responsibilities. But the point of the paragraph as a whole is not to help us choose good small group leaders in City Focus or Christian Unions or RML. It's to show God's people that there are so many of them, they need these small groups. And the fact that there are so many of them shows that God's been keeping his promises. So the reason they're still in the desert after all these years is not because God has dumped them. It's not because God has failed to deliver. He's been doing his part of all that he said he'd do. You see the drift of how Moses is beginning to argue with them, to take them back through their defeat and help them see the reason? Well, now look at verse 19. In verse 19, they move out just as they've been instructed. They break camp. Must have been chaotic, mustn't it? But they did. And they make that 11-day journey from Horeb towards Kadesh Barnea at the end of verse 19. Well, they've got to the edge of the land, the bottom left-hand corner. People want to check it out and say, well, can we send some spies in to see what it's really like? And Moses says, yes, that's a good idea. Why don't you do that? So they do, and they go, and they check out the land, and they come back. And the land is wonderful. The point of the paragraph comes in verse 25, the last line. Spies come back and they say, it is a good land that the Lord our God is giving us. They've just been through a dreadful desert and they suddenly arrive. It is a good land that he's prepared for us. See, God's promised land was not like a Spanish hotel, still a building site when they got there. God's people didn't travel for what felt like 11 years from Manchester Airport and find a few old goats living in a field where their luxury holiday apartment was supposed to have been built for them. See, God's promises are not like those in brochures at the bottom end of the travel business. His are accurate in every detail. And when they checked out the land, when they walked through the land from bottom to top and back again, it was a good land, just as God said it would be. And again, you see, once again, the point of the paragraph is to show us that it's not God's fault that they're still in the desert, 40 years on. So, are we beginning to get our bearings where these people are? They're not yet in the land. They're on the right-hand side, on the east of the Jordan. They have the promises of God behind them. God had already made them into a great nation, too many to count, massive numbers of them, like the stars. They'd all started from one little chap, Abraham. God had rescued them from the local superpower, from Egypt. God had spoken to them at Mount Sinai. And so far on their journey, God has taken care of everything. Every little detail. And in front of them, they have this tremendous vision of God's blessing for them. It's a brilliant land. It's a wonderful land that he's got ready just for them. They've been dreaming of it. Now they've seen it. And it is fantastic. So why are they still in the desert? 40 years later than these particular events that Moses is describing. Why are they there on the right-hand side of the land, instead of on the bottom left-hand corner, ready to go in to all that God has prepared for them? Well, verses 26 to 46 tell us the reason. We're going to spend our time here. It's your own fault, says Moses. It's your own fault. It's not God's fault. It's your fault. What we'll do is we'll run through these verses relatively quickly, 26 to 46, and then we'll stop on one of them. I'm conscious that I'm having to cover quite a bit of material, so we are going to slow down. We will stop in one place and think about one particular verse together. Look at verse 26. You were unwilling to go up, says Moses. You rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. He said, go in and take the land. You said, no way. You grumble, verse 27, in your tents. I don't know if you can imagine them doing it, the kind of noises that would have come from around the campsite as they protested at the idea of going up into the land, sort of rhubarb, 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 coming from a tent over here and another one over there, and maybe the women were meeting over here and they were making noises over there and men over there too, all of them beginning to complain. And look what they're saying in verse 27. It's utterly absurd. They say, the Lord hates us. And so he brought us up out of Egypt to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites, the people who live in the land, to destroy us. So all this Exodus stuff, all this journey has been because God hates us. And what God really wants for us is to put an end to us. It's perverse, isn't it? It's the exact opposite of the truth. Well, what's the reason for it? Well, listen to their fear in verse 28. So they talk about what the spies have said about the land. Verse 28, the spies say, the people are stronger and taller than we are. The cities are large, well, we can never take them. And listen to their military technology. Walls right up to the sky, they say. And we even saw Anakites there. And Anakites are a kind of giant. In boxing terms, I suppose this is the military equivalent of saying, you must be joking if you think we're going in the ring with them. These people are the equivalent of Mike Tyson written large. And look at the way Moses deals with them. He doesn't play down the obstacles ahead of them. He doesn't say to them, well, they weren't really giants. They just had a lot of jerseys on that particular day. He acknowledges that there are giants in the land. He doesn't deny the problems they're going to face in taking this good land that God has prepared for them. On the other hand, Moses doesn't seek to build their own self-esteem. He doesn't say, you're really quite strong yourselves, you know. Think of all the muscle building you've been doing recently. He doesn't do either of those things. He turns their attention away from themselves and their own weakness and away from the giants, and he reminds them how great God is. They are going to have to take some big cities with big defences, but they need to remember how big God is. And Moses uses two vivid images to bring home God's love and concern for them. They're familiar to us, but I don't think we know that they were here. Verse 29. Then I, that's Moses speaking, said to you, "Do not be terrified. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God, who is going before you, will fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt, before your very eyes and in the desert." You see the picture of God that Moses sets before them? God is a successful soldier, a victorious warrior. "You know that," says Moses. "You've seen that. Look what he did to Pharaoh, the major superpower. He completely destroyed him." "Well," says Moses, "he's the one who'll be leading these next attacks as we go forward and take the land. So don't be afraid of a few giants." But then God is not just a soldier. He's also a loving father. Verse 31, and I love this picture. Verse 31, "There in the desert you saw," says Moses, "how the Lord your God carried you as a father carries his son, all the way you went until you reached this place." Isn't that a wonderful picture of God's relationship with his people? It seems that Moses is thinking of the people of God as being like a kind of toddler, going for a ride on their father's shoulders. It's not father and son walking side by side, big father, little boy, father holding the child's hand as they toddle along. Now look at verse 31 again. "You saw how the Lord your God carried you all the way." Well, most fathers, when they've carried their sons most of the way, don't dump them and leave them to manage the last bit by themselves. See the force of Moses' argument? He's carried you. He's cared for you all the way until now. What makes you think he'll drop you in it from here on in? But look what happened in verse 32. "In spite of this, you did not trust in the Lord your God." And then we hear about God's reaction from verses 34 to 40. "When the Lord heard what you said," says Moses, "he was angry." Well, that's not surprising, is it? In verse 35, God swore that not one of this first generation who left the land would actually make it into the promised land. Those who left Egypt would all die in the desert, except for Caleb and Joshua. Only two of them would make it into the land. And then in verse 41, look at the people's reaction. Again, the next paragraph. "Then you replied," says Moses, "oh, we have sinned against the Lord." They finally got the point. "We will go up and fight as the Lord our God commanded us. So every one of you put on his weapons, thinking it easy to go into the hill country. But the Lord said to me, 'Tell them, do not go up and fight, because I will not be with you. You will be defeated by your enemies.' So," says Moses, "I did tell you, but you would not listen. You rebelled against the Lord's command, and in your arrogance you marched up into the hill country, and the Amorites destroyed you." It's a somber story, isn't it? It really is, a story of extraordinary perversity. When God brings them in his generosity to the edge of the land, the very edge of the land, and brought them all the way from Egypt, fulfilling his promises to Abraham, setting this massive vision of the land before them, he says, "Go take it." They say, "No way, it's full of giants." And then when God says to them, "Well, don't go up into it then. Go back in the desert." They say, "Yes, yes, yes, we will. And off they go and get defeated. When it's the promised land, they won't go near it. When it's forbidden territory, they won't stay out of it. Well, now look at verse 45. Here's the verse we're going to concentrate on for the last few moments. Verse 45. Moses says, "You came back and wept before the Lord, but he paid no attention to your weeping and turned a deaf ear to you." Isn't that a devastating scene? Here are the people of God in floods and floods of tears, and God is deliberately paying no attention whatsoever to their weeping. He's ignoring them and refusing to listen to them, just as they've refused to listen to him. I remember, I think about 2 or 3 years ago now, walking through an alley just off Cornhill early one morning. I don't know what I was doing. It was before 9. And I walked past a woman in her early 20s, and she was in floods and floods of tears. Maybe some man had brought her relationship to an end. I don't know. Perhaps her mother was ill. She was obviously very distressed. Maybe it was just that someone had kidnapped the budgie or something like that. I mean, I have no idea what it was that was upsetting her. And I didn't stop to ask her. But I've never forgotten her. There was something about her tears that got through to me. It got under my skin. Look at verse 45 again. Moses says, "You came back and wept before the Lord, but he paid no attention to your weeping and turned a deaf ear to you." Here's the Old Testament church of God, if we can put it like that, in tears before the God of Abraham, the God who's proved to them again and again and again how much he loves them, the God who's been faithfully keeping his promises to them, the God who's prepared the most fabulous land for them, and he's ignoring them. I want to suggest that although this is a rather negative picture of God's people, it's well worth staying with it just for a few moments now. It's a way of us thinking about God's people today. It has a tremendous amount to teach us about the difficulties we face as God's people today. Just in case you think that's a crazy thing to do, would you turn forward with me to page 1151? 1151. Keep a finger in Deuteronomy. I just want to show you why it's possible to read these verses about God's Old Testament people to teach us as his New Testament people. 1151. This is Paul speaking in his letter to the Corinthians and in chapter 10. I'm not going to read more than one verse. The first few verses, he's talking about these same events. Verse 1, "Our forefathers were all passed under the cloud and through the sea. All went following Moses, all ate the same spiritual food." And then various difficulties in verses 6 to 10 happened to them along the way. So he's talking about the same overall events that we're looking at, the journey from Egypt to the promised land. Now look at verse 11. Paul says, "These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us New Testament believers, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come." So he says, if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Now, with Paul as our guide, let's go back to Deuteronomy and ask ourselves, well, what can we learn from this astonishing picture of God's people in tears before God and God ignoring them? Well, think about what happens when sometimes we're facing a spiritual crisis as an individual or as a family or as a church family, perhaps as a Christian organization, a CU or a camp. So many things have gone wrong for us, and there seem to be such massive obstacles lying ahead of us that it does begin to feel at times, doesn't it, as if the Lord is no longer with us. It's not at all clear that he's on our side, but things are going so swimmingly that it's obvious that God is behind us. Even if we shrink from using the language of verse 27, where they said, "The Lord hates us." And then I don't know if you've had this experience, but a friend or a preacher does the equivalent of what Moses tried to do for God's people here. And he says this, "Well, I know things may be tough, but, well, look back at what God did for us at the cross when he defeated our spiritual enemies. Think of what God did for us through Jesus." He goes on, he says, "And look back at the way God has faithfully cared for us as Christian people over the years." Well, what kind of impact does that have on us in that sort of situation? Well, I would say it doesn't always work, does it? It doesn't always solve the problem to say, look back to the cross and remember God's faithful care, does it? It didn't work for Moses. And the kind of approach that the same dynamics taking us back to God's great victories in the past don't always work, solve the problem immediately for us today. It doesn't always put an instant end to our reluctance to trust God. Sometimes we still stay in verse 32. "In spite of all this, we still will not trust the Lord our God." You see, it's a mistake to distance ourselves from these people too quickly and say, "Well, we'd never do that kind of thing." We're rather closer to them than it first seems. Let me take a different example. Again, from this same setting, God's people before him in tears, and him apparently ignoring them. Think about how many new Christian initiatives have started over the years, beginning with a big fanfare, only to come to nothing. Look at verse 41. They didn't all begin there in the second half of verse 41, thinking it was easy to go up into the hill country, easy to advance God's kingdom, easy to push back the boundaries of opposition to him. But a good many of them did start like that. And a good many of them end in verse 45 in tears. And if you know that in the last 10 years or so, in this country only, a new Christian organization has begun every 3 working days on average. Every 3 working days for 10 years. Now, if you're a student, do you write an essay every 3 working days? Well, I'm sure you do. In which case, you're keeping up with the pace at which new Christian organizations have been starting over the last 10 years. Now, they don't all stop for these reasons, but some of them do. Look again at verse 45. You came back, Moses said, and wept before the Lord, but he paid no attention to your weeping and turned a deaf ear to you. When one of my sisters is really shattered, the way she likes to relax is to take the sofa for the afternoon and a box of tissues and an old black and white TV movie. And by the time the film comes to an end, the box of tissues is empty, and she's feeling much better, and she's had a really good howl. She loves having a good cry. Do you know the feeling? So come and tell me about it afterwards if you like doing the same. Now look again at verse 45. The tears in verse 45 are not like that. They're not satisfying tears. You don't feel better after crying them. They're bitter and painful tears. And they're in the script, whether we like it or not. And most of us will find ourselves living in verse 45 at some stage or other in our lives. We'll find ourselves there because of some area of our lives, as individuals, or as a family. Most families have something, sooner or later in their experience, that takes them into verse 45. You may find that it's part of a congregation or a Christian movement. And it may be our fault, or it may be somebody else's. Maybe it's a relationship or a health issue or isolation or a specific temptation. Maybe something nobody else knows about, but we'll be there in verse 45. And some of us live there at the moment. And however much we weep or pray or cry out to the Lord, it's as if he is not listening. He seems deaf. And we could find ourselves staying there for as long as these people did, for many, many, many days. Nothing seems to happen. So how is it that God and his people get beyond this point? How is it that God and his people can be reconciled to each other? Well, as soon as I put it like that, some of us can see the answer. Later in the Bible, we see God shedding tears of his own as his own people rejected him. And we see him using their rejection as part of the whole process of reconciling them to him, of putting these tears to an end once and for all, ultimately. Verse 45 does seem utterly negative, doesn't it? The good news about it is that although it's in the story, it isn't the end of the story. And the fact that verse 45 is not the end of the story reminds us that God doesn't always ignore our tears. He doesn't always or forever turn a deaf ear to our cries. He may move much, much, much more slowly than we would choose if we were in charge. He may leave us crying and weeping for far longer than we think we can ever cope with. But sooner or later, he does make the next move. And as Moses said, as the Father who carries his Son and has carried us all the way up to this point, he's not going to give up on us now. Let's pray together. You came back and wept before the Lord, but he paid no attention to your weeping and turned a deaf ear to you. Our Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for this sober picture of part of what it means to be belong to your people. Thank you for the realism of your word. Thank you, though, that this is not the end of the story. Thank you that you yourself know what it is to shed tears. Thank you that we can see you doing that in the Lord Jesus Christ. And thank you that he died on the cross to bring a day, to make a day possible when there will be finally no more tears, when you will wipe every tear from our eyes. And we ask that you'll help us to go on trusting you through the tears and looking forward to that great day when they will be no more. And we ask it for the honour of your name. Amen.
Let's close by entrusting ourselves to God. All my hope on God is founded. There will be an opportunity to give to the work of St. Helens, if you would like to, as the bags come around during this hymn. But let's turn to our strong deliverer, our mighty Redeemer. All my hope on God is founded. Please stand.